sound in my voice. I said,
I'll put in then. And there you go, it's recording again. Oh,
so this is continuing interview at Byron Station. Liz Chappell talking to Christine Swan on the 14th of June 2017. Thank you. So when I chatted to Bill, we got up to the point where you just got married and moved into the cottage. But we got a little bit about his mother's garden, but that's probably a good place for us to start, Christine, and talk about the garden that you came to here at Byron Station.
Well, she was a really gifted gardener. If she couldn't get a plant growing, nobody could here. The garden was exceptional. She entered the Sydney Morning Herald garden, came second a few times, but was always beaten by old Bunny Lloyd out at Yowai, who I think won it 9 or 10 times in a row. So there was a bit of friendly banter went on there that sometimes got a bit horrid. But the garden was much smaller than it is now. And she did most of the work herself. She did have an old fellow who lived in the cottage, one of the cottages on the place. He came every now and again, but she really did most of the heavy work. And she pushed a lawnmower, really, and then wonder of wonders got a victor. But she used to laugh and say it was like painting the Harbour Bridge. You know, she'd just get around it and have to turn around and start again. I can't even imagine that, because what we call the inside garden is what she had, and there's no way I'm going to push a lawnmower over this.
Roughly what size was that, do you think, Christine?
I'm not very good on sizes, but, you know, all the internal garden.
Pretty much where the fence is now?
Yes, pretty well.
And the trees, did she plant some of the trees that we see, or were they earlier?
No, quite a lot of them were earlier. The Fittinias, she would have planted the claret ash, I think.
Do you want me to... I think I know how to stop and start again.
The pine trees, the Fittinia, the peace bush. There's still quite a lot of old, really old 1890 trees. She planted trees. She was sort of living in the house and doing the garden before it became fashionable to be old. You know, it wasn't a new house when she lived here.
Yes.
And the garden hadn't been cared for at all over the war. So she sort of started everything from scratch. But some of the trees and things she planted, for instance, out on the old tennis court, which is where the entrance to the house, should never, ever have been allowed to be put where she did. But it wasn't... She didn't know the value of what she was... where she was planting.
Now, for the sake of people who can't see it, can you tell me what was planted there?
Well, there were two... what do you call little apples?
Crab apples?
Crab apples, yes. Two different sorts of crab apples. And her idea, I think, was to have a sort of a bower of crab apples she walked under to get to the house. Now, there was... the grapefruit tree, that's very old. The pine, the big old pine that's there, and I don't know what.
So is that a cypress pine?
Yes.
Yes, one of the young, tall Italian type cypress.
Yeah, well, there were two of those, one each side of the steps, which I think led onto the tennis court. But there is an old barbecue hidden in the garden that is growing all around that now, and that pine tree, blue spruce sort of thing, that was planted by Pixie Clyde Smith just before Bill and I were married in 1964. So you can see how long we've been married now by the size of that pine tree.
I'm sorry, the lady who planted it, Pixie Clyde Smith, can you tell us who she was?
She was a Donaldson, I think, and there were four sisters, and Pixie was one of them, and they lived sort of Warriola and Inverell.
So she was a family friend.
Yes.
Yes.
Bit of an entrepreneur. She considered herself a gardener, and she considered, I think today she would have been probably a garden designer. She had ended up with a very big garden at Tenterfield, just before she died. She lived up there and had an enormous garden up there. Anyway, she planted these things. But these, to go back to the crab apples, never ever put crab apples where you're going to walk a lot, because they lose their little apples and they fall down on the ground and then they ferment and the smell is awful. The mulch that people walk through and then walk straight into your house is absolutely dreadful. And if it's not little apples, it's leaves from autumn, or it's flowers in spring. So they're really a very pretty tree, but just put them way out in the paddock. And then the big pine tree that's there, that if I ever win lotto, that'll be the first tree that I will chop down.
It's not the standard radiata pine,
no,
is
that's,
it?
We lost one of those early in the piece. I don't remember the two being there, but obviously the little set of steps, you had one each side of the set of steps. Well, there's only one there now, and the big sort of whatever it is, blue sprucey thing, it's had the side cut out of it because it was growing into the old pine, the Italian type pine that was there. So it's had, because the gardener that was here, the man, tree man, he said, no, out of the two trees, this is valuable, this is not. He said, we'll take the side out of the big pine to keep the slender one going.
Oh.
So, you know, that suited me, because the big old blue spruce thing, it's just a nightmare tree. It's doing something disgusting just about the whole year. And it does what we call smoke. The pollen from it can happen 4 or 5 times a year. Just this yellow powder comes out in great clouds. So much so that sometimes I've been working with Bill in the cattle yards, looked down here and thought the house was on fire, and I've come racing over the hill to see whether a log's fallen out of the fire or the stove's caught alight or something. And it's just the powder that, and being the old house, of course, the windows don't close properly and the doors don't close properly. It sifts in, and there is no way you can get that off unless you go around with a damp cloth and you wipe it off, knowing full well in 5 minutes' time I will come back and there it will be again. So my housekeeping is really hit and miss. I'm a big believer in if it comes in, it'll go out. So I open all the doors and windows on both sides of the house and hope for a windy day.
Sounds reasonable to me.
And the same goes for the tractors that are working around here. I get an awful lot of dirt and dust and things, but there's no way I can keep it out because there is nothing that closes properly. And we have 6 fireplaces, and not one of them has a lid over the top. So the muck and stuff that comes down there, it rains, everything comes down, hits the grill and comes out on the carpet or the flooring around it. And we're never ever going to be killed from asphyxiation because there's that much cold air coming into the house. So
yes, then, they've never dealt with drafts. So moving around the garden, can we take a little bit of a virtual walk? So
yes, well, we come down then to a big Chinese elm. It is a weeping Chinese elm. And again, it is far too close to the house, but I know Nell planted that. Down there, there's a big... I don't know the name. I think it's one of those really old plants that's probably had 3 or 4 name changes, but it's a big yellow berry, and it is really quite valuable, I'm told, because the new cultivars of that are nowhere near as strong and healthy as the old one. And there's a red one in this corner of this garden over here, and I'm sort of in 2 minds about whether or not it's going to survive, but we'll get to that later. So the garden came round there, and then she planted various other trees, including that huge parotia out here, which is enormous. And it, I think she was probably training it into a tree, but it got away from me, and now it has many trunks, but it's really quite pretty. But only 1 year out of probably every 10 do we get the autumn colour that it's supposed to have. But it is an enormous tree, and I believe they're supposed to be 6 foot, you know, fully grown. Yeah. Well, I don't know how big this one is, but, you know, she's a big tree.
They're suitable trees for small gardens.
Yes.
Now, Bill did explain to me about the soil and the climate to an extent, but I can remember you saying that a visitor came here, I can't remember who it was, and you said how hot it got and how cold it got here, and they were just amazed that you gardened. Can you remember that story?
We've had a lot of botanical gardens from Melbourne and Sydney. They keep appearing every now and again. And we've had quite a few Sydney garden designers that just call in to have a look. And one of them, I left him outside in the garden. He walked around. Well, I went in and got some lunch. They all want lunch. he came in eventually and he said, you're only growing about the same three things over and over again. And I said, yes, well, honestly, that's about all I've found. I think I had small children at the time too. I said, you know, that's about all I can grow here. Oh, and he said, well, you know, your cold climate things don't look all that good. And I said, no, I know they don't. But I said, if they survive a summer here, it quite often gets, you know, we're back all those years ago, we were still getting, you know, 102, 103 days temperature. And I said, you know, so they've got to be fairly tough to survive that. He said, well, your hot things don't look too good either. And I said, no, they don't either. But I said, you know, we get down to -8 and -9 here, and it can be -8 or -9 for 3 or 4 weeks at a time without a break in the middle. Oh, heavens, he said, why on earth do you bother? And I said, well, if it had been left to me, I don't think I would. But I inherited when I married, so I'm stuck with it. Oh, that's setting back. Anyway, the three things that I grew at that stage were catmint, valerian, and what's the other thing? Oh, that little daisy, the...
Original?
Yeah, original. Yes, but there's what they make the garden spray out of? The
Pyrethrum
daisy. I said, those three things, I can make quite a pretty garden just with those three things. He went back out and had a look and he duly noted it. So anyway, that basic still. I've lost the catmint now, but that happened over the last 7 years. And I lost a lot of things then, including some of the big trees, which surprised me. They just couldn't handle it. It was very hot for a very long while, months at a time, and we were totally away, and Ben was flat out feeding and watering stock and things. And he had no time to look after my garden, so it wasn't looked after.
Do you think it was drought and heat or age of some of the trees?
Oh, I think probably all three, really. You know, they were, some of the trees weren't. Some of them came back, interestingly enough. Because I didn't have time, and I was over it, you know, I sort of thought, look, I can't handle this, you know, do one thing. So I didn't sort of chop anything down, and I didn't spray. Well, I don't believe in spraying at all. I don't spray at all. I might go through one small spray can of pyrethrum in 12 months, but otherwise anything that gets sick I feed. And if it still stays sick, well, I don't want to grow it, so I reef it out. If it gets better, well, that's good luck for the plant. But I was surprised at some of the big maple trees and things. They came back. Okay, this year they look a bit sick, but maybe next year, after the really wet year we've had this time, they may be, you know, vastly improved as a result of leaving them well alone. In other words, don't chop things down straight away. Give them a chance. They may survive. If they don't, well, get rid of it then.
Now, I distracted you on our garden walk when we were just about got to the witch hazel, to the parotia.
Yes, the parotia. Yes, well, then we come to the big old viburnum thing. No, it's not. What is it? The big old one out there. Everyone's growing as hedges this year. There's hedges everywhere.
The viburnum tinus.
No.
Commonly called laurustinus.
Yes, laurustinus. Yes. Yep. Yes. And that's what happens if you don't prune it. And I look at all these little houses with these little hedges around and I think, oh my goodness me. Be careful. But they're pretty. It's disgusting. for about 3 weeks of the year when it's flowering and the smell. I mean, it's not called the dyke tree for no reason. And the leaves don't compost at all. It's very thick, tough leaves. So I go round and round on the mower and I throw them all into the trunk. And it gets very badly affected by mould. A good friend told me, and she was talking about a tree with one trunk. This one out here is many trunks, and I haven't worried about the other two that are in the garden around the other side. This one really did suffer badly from mould. We tried bringing down the big spray we spray the sheep with and spraying the tops and things like that. Nothing worked. So this friend of mine, she said, look, I put... she was doing it around a crepe myrtle. Now they breed crepe myrtles that don't get rust, mould. So anyway, out I go with my little borer thing and I bored holes, but again, there's only I can do. I bored them straight in. I should have bored them at an angle because when I went out with the spray, well, I wasn't spraying, I was using it neat and I had a syringe, so you put the poison in the trunk neat. And each trunk, I think I put two or three holes in. Well, the first day was funny because it sort of came back straight out at me. So then I had to go around with my borer again and put the holes, you know, sink them down at an angle so that when I squirted the stuff in, it stayed in. And the second day, I think I found every 2 or 3 hours I had to go out because the tree took it up that quickly. And then the sort of the third and fourth day, it got less and less. And then I started to smell it coming out of the leaves of the tree. And next thing I noticed, all the mould had disappeared. Gone. Taken. Mm. So that got rid of that for that year. Then I had to go around and put blue tack in all the little holes. Anyway, it only took about 3 years of that treatment and the tree, touch wood, I haven't had any mould on it since. So, you know, I just keep a jolly good eye on it now because it's a very old tree and it's one of the signature trees. I really don't want to lose it. So there we are with that one. Then I've got the other berry bush over there, which is looking a bit sick, but it had a grapevine.
Now, was that the one we had trouble working out what it was?
Yes, over there. It had a grapevine, an old man ivy and a jasmine growing all up over the whole lot. Well, it took two men a whole day with me hovering on the edges trying to help and getting in the way. I started at the bottom and I cut about a foot up the trunk and just left all. I thought, it's very brittle. If I go hauling that down, I'm going to break the branches and I don't want to do that. Eventually, all that dead will fall down. If I cut it a foot up, I could stop it from growing up the tree again. So I've worked on that now for 12 months and I've still got mess underneath it. But that was, I cleared all that away because it was quite pretty, especially when the jasmine was flowering. But it was just full of snakes. So, and with the little dog, I couldn't run the risk. He used to go in there pouncing and on things and, you know, make it, yeah, I was concerned about him. And there's all Virginia creeper all growing along that fence too, which is beautiful. Then we get to the peace bush. It took 4 or 5 gardeners.
Now, which is...
That's this dead-looking one in the front here.
Straight here with the lovely gnarled
branches. Yes. Well, that's pollarded every year. I'll get into that shortly, although I might have to get a man to help this year.
Now, we were curious about what that was when we were here with the garden trip.
Yes, well, they still aren't terribly sure of what it is, but various gardeners have been here from both botanical gardens and a guy from Canberra, who I can't think of his name, but he's a lovely young man and we became quite friendly. They took cuttings and they burnt it and they tried growing it and just we couldn't find out anything. It's very like a buddleia, but it doesn't bend. It's very straight and it has... terrible little bullet-like seeds on it that when I'm cutting it back, get all down your front and everywhere, and they, you know, it's like underneath it builds up all these little seed pod things, slippery like little baby marbles almost. Not terribly pretty. I much prefer it in the winter when it's all the interesting bark and twists and turns on them. I think it's lovely then. It's a sculpture in the garden.
So you don't have any records of where Bill's mother might have sourced her plants?
And I'm not even sure. It might be older than that because it's got a stump down on the ground like that on it. And I don't think it'll grow. It doesn't seem to get any bigger. I'd say it's a very old tree. But finally, I think they decided that it was a peace bush. But I don't know why they sort of talk about that. I do
Stuart
have a
Reed.
Friend that says she has a peace bush that she bought at a nursery, but I haven't been to see it to see if it's the same tree, and I don't think it is. I think hers might be some more of a buddleia than this.
Mm.
So it'll be interesting to see anyway.
Stuart Reed no doubt has been amongst the people who have been here.
Yes, he's been here a couple of times.
He's not often beaten.
No, well, I think that might have beaten him. He decided he'd take the seeds home and see if it, you know, like wattle trees, they like a burn, fire, good hot fire. And I think he was going to take them home and see. I said, he kept sort of shoveling them into a bag. I said, yeah, take what you like, I don't want them. I don't want it to see. So, then there's not a lot of roses left in the garden. Nell had roses.
Mm.
I do not like roses. I don't like roses much. You know, they're not my go-to flower. They're beautiful to look at in pictures, and I sit there and I think, oh, you are beautiful, but I'm not willing to put the work
they
in.
Are hard work.
And then I've had a couple of, one very good friend who's a garden, Hughie Main. He's been here. He grew up here. He spent a lot of time here as a kid, and he came over one day to have a look and do things and photograph and things. And he said, no roses? And I said, no. I said, I think they're very expensive. It's really too hot here for them. And I said, you know, that's such hard work. And he laughed. He said, well, in Sydney, he said, all my ladies want roses. That's the first plant they want is roses. I've got to have roses. And he said, if only I could tell them that if they went to the most expensive florist in Double Bay every week for the whole year, they could buy as many roses as they like for put in their house. And he said, without all the expensive black spot and, you know, all the other rose diseases and prunings and worry about whether you're doing it right or wrong and all the rest of it, he said they would be far better off if they just went down to Double Bay and bought a lovely bunch of roses every week. And I laughed and I said, yes. I said, well, I can add a bit more extra to that too. I said, they'd need to have to buy another big bag of elastoplast, you know, sticking plaster. He said, what do you need that for? And I said, because when I touch my roses, I end up with sticking plaster all up and down my arms and my shirt. And he laughed. He said, yes. He said, I must add that to my list of do not plant roses.
But he tried to get his mother to get rid of hers when they were out on the farm. I think she kept about three.
Yes. Well, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, probably 6 roses left from Nell. And, you know, I keep, there's one in particular around this side. And the only reason I keep it is it is one of the few roses that does have lovely perfume. But every year I look at it and I think, I can't stand you, I'll dig you up and haul you, give you to the cattle. Then we come round to the front hedge, which is a lovely mixture of elm and privet and hawthorn, all mixed in together. And it's always been like that.
Right.
Ever since the year Dot. It had a whole heap of big pines along in front of that, between the hedge and the paddock, but I'd say they were 1890, probably full trees then in 1890. The garden actually ran in a half circle, the fence was a half circle, but of course it fell down, the timber fell down, and Bill being a good country boy, the fence had to be in straight lines, didn't it? So I now have straight lines there.
Is there a photograph of the curved one?
Well, the curve's still there.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, the hedge is still curved.
Oh, right, so the hedge is where the fence was, yes.
But Nell, being a gardener, she any bulbs and things she dug up, she didn't like them or she didn't know what they were, she pelted them over the side of the hedge, just over. And the cattle, of course, couldn't get at it because they had the fence was there. And it is just the most wondrous garbage tip I've ever seen in my life. I don't add any fertiliser or anything. It just gets leaf mulch. I mow a path, you know, woodland-like, down the side. But the same bulbs don't pop up every year. Some years it's a mass of daffodils. And then I mightn't see daffodils there for 10 years. This now, at the moment, it's got jonquils, and I'm not awfully fond of jonquils, but they're okay. It's sort of paddock-like out there. They're coming up. Other years, it might be full of English bluebells, or, you know, just nothing ever comes. Just every now and again, you go out, and there'll be this mass of these bulbs all deciding, except for one little weeny bulb that might grow, I don't know, perhaps 2 inches. The whole plant is about 2 inches, and it's thick, and it has a little tiny bell-like flower on it that has got a blue rim on it, no perfume or anything, and it just sits there looking like a little dead head until about 4:30 in the afternoon, when it's got the western sun. It's had the heat on it all day. It's got the western sun shining on it at that hour, and all of a sudden all these little heads open up, and they stay there till about 7:30 or 8:00 at night. Then you go out, you know, to have a bit of a look and say, aren't you pretty? And they've all gone to sleep again.
And you don't know what it is?
I don't know what they are. No. I've tried photographing them, and I probably could find a photo in my thing of what they are. But I don't know. I don't know. It's just the fact that they open so late and close so early. And, you know, the same little head will open and close probably, you know, every day for a week or 2 weeks.
Right.
And it's just fascinating. And they come every year. You know, I do seem to have them every year.
Well, that's one for Stuart Reed too.
Yeah, well, I didn't think about him when he was here.
Well, they've got to be here at the right time to see them.
They're not flowering now. The only thing out there, and I only know that because we walked around this morning, is a couple of bunches of jonquils. But see, it's had such a hammering in the last, 3 years particularly, when Bill's been so ill, that I don't, you know, I don't know what's going to survive and what isn't.
Mm.
So, anyway, it'll be interesting to see.
But that bulb section's always got by without any extra
water or fertiliser. She never even covered the bulbs up. She just would carry a shovelful over, heave them over, and not go near them again. I suppose every now and again she'd go and pick a bunch of, say, daffodils if they were there or whatever, but I don't know. They grew for her. They don't grow for me. They did for her. She probably spat on them as she put them over or something.
It's the climate change.
So, she planted the grapefruit tree and the liquid amber, which I nearly lost, this big one here, because of the heat and no water. I lost a big one down near the old stables. I've saved one down there. I thought it was going to go, and I'm not sure whether it might still go, and another big one outside there, and it's just hanging on too. But I think that's climate. I think just it's too tough for it. The elms, well, we had a real thicket growing out there. That was where the cattle, until we started farming this paddock underneath the house here, we always had stock in there, and the cattle used to like to come up and lie in the elms, and of course they kept all the suckers under control. Then we started farming, and all of a sudden I had, well, you couldn't see through it even. So I have a very good friend who sprays for the Shire, and I said to him one day, you know, look, I just can't get rid of these elm suckers. I don't want to hurt the big trees. I want them to stay if they can, but I'd like to get rid of the suckers. So he looked at me and he said, oh, leave it to me. He said, I'll think about it. And he came out about a month later and he had sprayed all these things with something, and he has done a wonderful job. The big trees are still there, and the suckers are all just sticks now. They totally disappeared, but again, we have had no stock in there to eat them as they're coming back. And probably, I don't know, another 10 years I might have to get him back to respray. So whatever it was he used was wondrous.
A lot of people would love to know what that was.
Yes, because the base tree is still there.
Yes, because that's what frightens most of us. Yeah. To spray the suckers that it's going to be taken up by the main tree.
That's right, yes. Well, he did tell me, be prepared. He said, it might work or you might lose a lot. And I said, well, I can't bear what was happening anyway. I said, I'd rather lose the lot than put up with the screen, really. So thick you couldn't walk through out there. Mm-hmm. And then there's a big, each end of the hedge, there's a big oleander. With a stump the size of this house, and I would really like to. I know they're full of rabbits, the two of them are home to every feral animal that ever lived on the earth, but of course with cattle, even if I break a tiny branch of oleander off, I have to cart it around and put over the fence on what we call the internal back garden, so that the stock can't eat it.
Yeah, because they're toxic, aren't they?
Yes. One, we lost a beautiful heifer out the front here, and Bill opened her up, and she'd had one leaf of oleander in her, and they said that's what killed her.
Gee.
So, you know, it's not worth the effort.
No, it'd be an expensive bull for sure if anything happened to anything.
That's right, yes. And it's difficult to get the truck in. You know, I keep thinking, well, bring the truck around and chainsaws and, you know, hack the two of them down, and they will look terrible for a couple of years, but okay, that's all right, you know, they'll come back again. Anyway, we can't get the truck in, so those two things are still there, with all their little animals living in there, so anyway. Then we come round the other side, and there's a big Chinese elm round there, and they're a nightmare near the house, because every little leaflet has got to come down. And quite often it's still losing its leaves while the new ones are coming and that sort of thing. The lawn is growing underneath it. I've got a paddock of beautiful bush orchids around there, and I was going to get in and clean them out because they're really taking over. But then I looked and I thought, oh, nothing else is going to grow in there. Leave them. So I do, and every now and again I run the mower down there and just chop off the top, and it looks a bit crooked for a while. Couple of big may bushes, and you know, filled up with everyday shrubs. But the thing with this house is the age of the house sort of has to fit the age of the flowers and plants and garden furniture that you've got. You can't put any of this modern garden furniture out in the garden. It looks silly in a house that's 180 years old. And the plants are the same, I have found. It's easier to grow the same plant over and over again. Just vary the sizings and that sort of thing. But I can't get sucked in by the latest fad, which at the moment I think is having all your little shrubs cut into little bowls.
That's
varying sizes and things. Charming, but it looks silly in this house. So,
now you mentioned that this was a garden that you inherited. Has that limited you, do you feel, in what you can do?
No. My mother-in-law, I know not long after we moved here, I lost something and I was very upset about it. And she came down and she said, look, dear, she said, plants get old and die. She said, don't worry. She said, if you really want it, plant it again. And I thought, oh, how sensible is that? So no, it hasn't. And the fact that so many people really have come here and enjoyed it, all the open days we've had and the open garden, but it's been open a lot for local people and things like that. You know, they just walk around, and one lady sat down in a heap down there. She died not long afterwards. And I sort of knew her, and she was just sitting down there under a tree, and I went down and sat beside her, and she said, oh, I do enjoy this. She said, it has a very nice feel about it, this garden. She said, it's unfussy. And I said to her, she said, you don't mind me saying that? And I said, that's one of the nicest compliments I've ever been told, you know, been mentioned to me. Because they talk about me as being sort of the untidy gardener, I like it neat and tidy, but I'm not particularly fussed about bits popping up where they shouldn't. And you know, I don't spray at all, and I try to let things seed themselves in what we now call a wedding garden, because that's where my daughter had she was married, out in the sort of outside section out there.
That's where the second tennis court was, is that?
Yeah, the second tennis court's here.
Oh, I've lost my bearings.
Yes, it's out there, to right. The northern
yes.
side. Probably twice a year, the big gardens out there, and they're quite wide gardens, they look absolutely shocking because everything's dead. I'm waiting for the seeds to drop off. Then I can go in and clean it up and, you know, just pat it all down, leave it and see what happens next year. Nearly always, everything comes up again. Occasionally, I lost all the cornflowers 2 years ago, and I think that was heat and no water because we were away. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes back this year.
Do you mulch or fertilise that?
Those
borders?
Not in a huge way. I'm too lazy to do too much. I do put down hay, but it's straw, not good hay. It's straw from the barley, usually, before we get a frost, because I think that might just sort of help roots and things like that. And if I think it's getting very hot in the summer, I'll try to put down something around the roots of anything new that I put in. But I don't really fertilise. I used to bring down a lot of manure from Paradise. That was beautiful manure, but it was also beautifully full of blackberries and briars and things, and they used to get a good hold before I realised they were there. And then once they were there, they were very difficult to get out of, so I stopped that. Occasionally, I've nearly always got a bag of fertiliser here so that if something looks crook, it'll get a couple of handfuls of... Then I forget, you know, I go somewhere and do something and I forget all about it. Oh, look, it's getting better. You know, that's good, isn't it? So here, have another feed. And I'll probably overfeed it. But we're having rabbit trouble at the moment. And round the trees, even the quite big trees, they're ring barking, the trees. So the best thing I have found is to go to town to one of the building supply places. And they've always got sheets of that blue... It's blue on one side and silver on the other, and I think it's insulation stuff.
Yes.
Chop that up into chunks and wrap that around and tie it with a piece of string. And you can go quite high so that the hairs and things can't... And I just put those around. And after the tree or the shrub or whatever it is you're trying to protect has been in for a couple of years, the rabbits leave it alone. So you don't have to sort of keep it that. But that blue stuff stays on really well. I've tried magazines and things like that, but they rot away too quickly before I go out. You know, there's other things to do besides gardening.
Exactly.
In life at the moment.
And how do you fare for water supply?
Oh, I've got good water, but there's always a but. I have no way of putting it on the garden apart from moving hoses, and I have very long hoses, which take some hauling around the garden, and we've got pressure, so I've got reasonable pressure, but I doubt here the setup we've got that I could ever have an underground watering thing. It's too dirty. We've tried on tree lines and things going up to the cattle yards from here up to the cattle yard, but we just can't keep the water, you know, the little holes just block up with pebbles and bugs and all the other things, so it is easier to drag the hoses. And then the other day, I mean, this is how stupid you can be in all this rain, and I'm looking at things and they're starting to get waterlogged and looking a bit sick, and I think, oh, I think the drought was better where I could choose how much water everything got rather than this, God, you know, here it comes again and having to dig a trench to drain things.
Yes.
So,
and anything with grey leaves...
Yes.
Goes to heaven.
Yes. So, you know, I just Yeah, I'm never satisfied. It's what it comes down to.
You did mention that the driveway had changed from the original layout to where you drive in at the back now. Was that something that you and Bill did, or was it done before?
Probably before Nell's day even, the down there at the T-junction, halfway along that flat, which is underwater, the road branched off and came across the paddocks up to this gate that's just out here.
Yeah.
And then they came in round the drive, and then back out, I presume. This was the back gate out here, where we now park. I suppose they got sick of the black soil, heavy black soil, and the stones and things like that coming across there. So they brought the road up to the where the mailbox is now, down past the cattle yards, and we pull up here. The front of the house is round here, which when you walk in the front gate there, between the hole in the hedges, it's positioned exactly with a set of steps each side, and the door's off centre because there's another door down at the other thing, but they didn't think about that in those days. But the front gate then turned around from being this side of the house to being this side of the house. But everybody used to come, and they would, I don't know how, come through the gates and find themselves at that back kitchen door across the back veranda, and which is interesting in itself because, anyway, I'll come back to that. But this landing where you sort of walk in with the two pillars inside it, we had to have the pillars because the roof line, the shingles come down to about an inch above where that is, and there was no way they were going to be able to hold the roof up because it is so big and so heavy and it's all shingled that we had to have those two pillars, which upset my plans for that veranda. But anyway, beggars can't be choosers. So we turned that into the little porch, hoping that people would come in the gate, across the courtyard, across the tennis court, into the courtyard and lead to the front door. Sometimes it works, mostly it doesn't. They still go round onto the back veranda, which is where that when Nell lived here, without fail, if it rained on the western hill over here on the other side of the river, she would say, shut up the western side of the house, you're going to get rain here. Well, very rarely these days does the rain come in this way. The rain goes right around over Inverell and comes in over the rubbish dump and that area there and comes in, so it gets the back veranda, which, of course, was where everyone hung their raincoats and you leave your gumboots and, you know, all that stuff. Well, now all that gets wet continually. Mm. And I think the difference there is the Copeton Dam has made a difference. It's sucked the water, the clouds out there, and it's sending it out here, and then it comes back this way where it used to come that way. So very rarely now do I ever have to come and shut the windows and things on or doors on the western side of the house because it just doesn't rain there. It all comes in this side.
Isn't that curious?
So, and I think it's osmosis or whatever they call it, you know.
Have you noticed other changes in getting hotter or colder, or is that just a cyclical thing that's happening?
Oh, well, I think it's... I mean, we've always... Down here on the river, it's always been very cold or very hot. I can see no difference in that, I think. We've adjusted the house to being a bit warmer when it's cold, and it's beautifully cool in the summer because of the size of the roof and the shingles and the no ceilings and things like that. But, yeah... I don't know. I mean, people sit here and they say, oh, you're so lucky, you know, you live in a beautiful house, lovely garden, and I think, yes, well, I am lucky. I know I am lucky. But Billy's also lucky that I was willing to live here and learn to live here. I mean, I could have said, no, I'm not going to live there. And, you know, he would have been stuck between a rock and a hard place. So, you know, he's...
On my quick calculation, you've gardened here for over 50 years.
Yeah.
How has the garden changed over that time,
not
Christine?
Not a great deal. Nell had the front garden around here that I promptly filled up with shrubs and a tree. That was a standout garden. She always, without fail, it was full of the most beautiful red salvia. Just this fire burst of red salvia.
Mm.
And then she'd fill it in, you know, as that went off, she'd put other things in there. But, oh, so much work, so I wasn't going to do that.
Mm.
So that changed. The fish pond around there, she had it all terraced and, you know, dear little plants and things going around there. Well, I soon got sick of that, so, you know, there's lilies around there now and, you know, what else is there? Daffodils and aggies, agapanthus, you know, various things, like just little things. She had the time and the interest. Everything was sort of full of interesting plants, which is where her plants knowledge came in. I didn't have it, and I certainly haven't the interest that she had. I like the garden. I still get, after Bill's mowed the lawn, and say in the spring or a really hot summer's night, to walk around the corner and look at all this garden spread out here. I think, wow, you know, that is something. You know, that's pretty special. Mm. But Bill and I do laugh. He never looks inside the garden fence. He looks over at the cattle and the crops, you know, and we're sitting here having morning tea or something. Oh, look at that. Doesn't that look really good? And I say, yes, it does look really good, but I wish those flowers, you know, this hypericum here, it's a truly gold plant. I said, yeah, that weren't quite so yellow. It's not yellow. And he's looking at the oats on the other side and the cattle and things, and I'm looking at the garden. We just can't quite get it right when we're both looking at the same view with the same eyes. But I think, you know, we both would rather have the outlook. We've been in our garden visiting, been to a couple of gardens where they've actively set to work to cut out the view, you know, fence and lines of trees and things like that. Oh, dear, it worries me. I can't quite handle that. I'd like to be able to see over the fence.
Now, it's a pretty rare privilege to garden in the same garden for over 50 years.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Would you have any advice as a final question that you'd say you've learnt from gardening in this climate?
Well, don't be in a hurry to chop things out or dig things out and chop things down. If you like it, persevere with it. You can always plant another one if you really want it and it dies. I don't spray anything, as I say. A few roses I've got occasionally get aphid. But
do you spray herbicides for your gravel and paths?
Yeah, I use Roundup. And although we do have a fair thistle problem here, I think that comes in from over the fence. And we use, I think it's MCPA or something. I mean, that kills the thistle but not the grass.
Mm.
And I'm starting to use a bit of Roundup and the MCPA at the same time. But then I will, before you came, I had a big go about a month before you came so that everything was clean and tidy. Now I probably won't touch it again till the end of spring. So that, you know, I tried trying to use less of the Roundup. But again, you know, if it's going to make gardening more easy for me, where I can sit back and enjoy it, why not use it?
We have to do it.
It's going to be someone else's problem, you know, whatever the leftovers are. But if it's still growing, you know, I haven't killed anything with Roundup yet. I do not understand how people say, oh, I know friend of mine in town, she had beautiful jacarandas around a tennis court in town, which is a bit unusual in Inverell, and she put Roundup round and she killed every single jacaranda. And she said, no, she said it was the Roundup. I said, can't possibly have been. You can't have killed everything like you did. It's not possible. You must have sprayed on a windy day, or, you know, you've done something.
Mm-hmm.
You have done something. But because I can go around here, and I mean, a little wind like this, I could spray along here, but I'm very careful. I've got the nozzle about that far from the ground, and a little spray, and you know, you just go along. Be careful. Mm. But stony, heavy black soil, I just sometimes wish it wasn't quite so stony and wasn't quite so heavy, because as I've got older, I'm not into digging like I used to, so I don't.
Mm.
Don't. When in doubt, don't.
That's wonderful, Christine. Thank you very much. Is there anything else about the garden that maybe I haven't asked that you'd like to tell us?
No, I don't think so. No.
Well, Bill has the know-how to copy this.